This episode is made possible by Henson Shaving. Earlier this year, the NBER published a paper that made national headlines. If you didn't see it, basically, researchers found that a lot of companies are calling their minimum wage workers managers, when they aren't managers of anything, because that way, they can deny them overtime pay. It's a lot of companies. Panera, Verizon, JP Morgan, Publix, Walmart, Facebook, Staples, Lowe's, McDonald's, KFC, and Pizza Hut are all guilty of doing this at one point or another. We can all agree this is just another screwed up corporate thing to add to the pile. But it got me thinking. What's the deal with managers? I mean, the word is completely useless now, and it did used to have a purpose, right? And in this video, I want to talk about that purpose. Or rather, those purposes, with an S. Because it turns out that who your boss is, how much they suck, and how much we think about them sucking has actually changed a lot. Let's talk about the early 1900s. Management hasn't always existed. Yeah, there's been managerial duties for basically forever. Leadership roles at work go all the way back. But as a career, with defined responsibilities and privileges, management only became a thing a little over a century ago. At least, that's according to most academics, including the two sociologists who wrote this book that I'm going to pull from a lot in this video. And in their opinion, this relatively recent codification of management happened because management, the career, is and always has been one of the tools the capitalist ruling class uses to survive criticism. In their book, Boltanski and Cipello explain that capitalism has survived for the last century not because it's the best system or whatever, but because those at the top of capitalist society have been able to change capitalist ideology in line with people's complaints about it. In other words, capitalists have taken small parts of what socialists complain about and have changed the way they run their businesses and the government just enough to bring the pressure down without actually changing who's in charge. Taking one part of people's anger and adopting it so you don't end up with a revolution on your hands. And management, and managerial discourse, is one of the big tools with which they achieve this. This'll make more sense if you remember what the early 20th century was like. At this time, the world is experiencing one of the first major waves of organized socialist politics. Workers are coming together in larger and more powerful unions and political parties. They're striking a lot more. Those strikes are getting bigger, national, and against all odds, communists, socialists, and People's Party candidates are winning elections. The Soviet Union has just been established, becoming the first successful national revolution by a socialist party. The Second International is created by socialist leaders. And a capitalist crisis called the Humongo Depression is about to devastate the global economy and destroy any faith people still had in the system. Everywhere you look, the demands for something else are just growing louder. And what are people upset about? For starters, they're pretty unhappy about the new aristocracy. Capitalism wasn't supposed to have that, but large companies get passed down from father to son, and Mellon, Carnegie, and Rockefeller have more wealth and power than any person ever has. Meanwhile, people are tired of working 60-hour weeks for basically no pay, and giving most of their paycheck in rent to their boss/landlord. They're tired of racial and gender depression. They're tired of child labor. They're tired of cops beating them up when they voice their anger. Workers' rights might as well be written on toilet paper. This makes it, to put it mildly, not a super chill time to be a capitalist. Being immensely powerful and wealthy is great, that's never not been true, but the threats to that power have never been more real. People aren't just unhappy, they're burning shit, blocking railways, getting elected, getting into shootouts with cops, and even mounting successful revolutions. The idea that a revolution might happen in the US isn't so far-fetched, and that's a concern for the ruling class. So they needed a new ideology. Because, for centuries, capitalism had survived not just thanks to its huge imbalances of power, slavery, poverty, and brutal police repression, but because it had successfully justified itself to enough people. Capitalist economies are insatiable. They always need to grow. But people are very much satiable, so to get them to work more than they want to is pretty hard. Violence and poverty are pretty motivating for subsistence work, but giving people's labor a moral value will get them to produce extra, which capitalists can keep as profits. You need a capitalist ideology to give work that moral value, and the narrative enough people bought into for a while was that capitalism meant progress. Feudalism obviously meant stagnation, but this new system, that could not help but grow from year to year, could innovate and produce like nothing before. Progress, science, modernity, all came to justify the sacrifices and the suffering and the work of what was ultimately a pretty austere life. Not only was progress a big selling point, but capitalism also meant a new kind of freedom. People had more freedom to choose their job. They weren't as locked in from birth. And even though there was more inequality than before, unlike the kings of yore, the wealthy wrote books about donating most of their money back to society. The future felt like it was within reach, and the present was being sold as a major improvement. Basically, capitalist ideology was simple: freedom and modernity. But the future never came. And this new freedom wasn't all that free when you're spending your every waking hour in a factory and still coming out poor. It didn't take long for people to suss out that freedom and progress weren't really happening so long as a minority of factory owners could keep exploiting them forever. So the capitalist class came up with middle management. Factories were starting to produce a lot more anyway, so organizing this increased volume with managers was not only practical, it helped to get the less radical workers to calm down. It was a way to respond to the socialist critique without power actually changing hands. You want a less hereditary system? Perfect! Now you can achieve a higher status on merit and become a manager. You work a lot, you're still poor, and having access to consumer goods is the new definition of success and freedom? Fantastic! The role of the manager is the ticket to that middle class life. You want a more organized, less competitive, less chaotic model of production? Great! Now that management is here, not only is there a well-coordinated welfare state thanks to the New Deal, but there's also a more bureaucratic industry. By the 1930s, some of the criticisms of the left were answered by the creation of management. Capitalists compromised on the stuff that didn't matter to them. Old family traditions like passing down your company from father to son, and a few rights here and there with a meager social safety net, because it allowed them to not compromise on the most fundamental social hierarchy: capitalist on top, workers at the bottom. Managers just became a step in how they made their decisions, not a power that could challenge their authority. This way, they stay in charge, disappear into the background, and still reap the profits of an exploitation-driven production system. But now, not only do people feel like they can escape exploitation by moving up in the company hierarchy, anger from those who remain lower-class workers gets directed at the manager, a fellow wage worker, instead of at the company's owners. However, this only worked for a while. According to our two authors, until around about the 60s. The left inevitably found new ways to voice their discontent, because a new managerial class and New Deal policies didn't go nearly far enough. Neither could possibly hide the injustices of a system where a minority of people owned and a majority of people worked for them. Even if a small group of workers is better off, suffering and anger was still way too widespread to be stifled by the slim possibility of a middle-class life. Not only that, but international socialism is still developing rapidly at this time. The threat of revolution becomes real again now that the USSR is joined by Cuba, Vietnam, and China. System-changing revolution on a national scale has taken place multiple times at this point, so why not here? How, then, did people criticize capitalism at this time? Well, all the same criticisms of exploitation, misery, and injustice are of course still relevant, see the civil rights movement and the poor people's campaigns, but added to these items of social unrest are a new set of criticisms. Mass production gets criticized for its standardization. Consumerism becomes the object of generalized disapproval. People feel alone and alienated from each other in this new society. And the rigid hierarchies and bureaucracies within government and businesses also become popular targets for the left. People feel like just another cog in the machine, from the things they buy, to the things they do at work, to the kind of linear career trajectory they're expected to have. People are lacking autonomy and human connection. Like in the 1920s, then, capitalism responds to these critiques by absorbing and claiming for itself a small part of them. Not enough to change who has power, just enough to survive and quiet down the revolutionary masses which are rightfully angry about the status quo. This is when neoliberalism and neoliberal rationality comes into play. In politics, the left-wing critique of hierarchy transforms into the conservative, neoliberal critique of government. And this gets completely appropriated by Reagan and Thatcher, who are dead set on making this seem like a government-only kind of thing. And at work, this criticism of hierarchy becomes transformed into self-management. Open spaces and cubicles gain popularity as workers are entrusted to supervise one another. Throughout the economy, the rigid bounds of a career are made more flexible by the discourse of opportunity, Now what's valuable is being able to go from one project to another, not sticking around so long at the same company. At the same time, the loneliness and alienation of capitalism is solved by networking. The lack of autonomy people felt is flipped on its head entirely when people are now free to move from job to job. Free to set your own hours. Free to develop as many skills as possible to make sure you never become unemployable. And the government is there to make sure people abide by this vision of freedom. These ideas become the classic combo of neoliberal policies we all know and love. Deregulate employment to make firing easier, collective rights weaker, social security non-existent. You know the deal. If the freedom of the previous era of capitalism was the freedom to be a middle-class worker, freedom that only a few meritocrats would attain, the new freedom of the post-60s capitalism is the freedom to be on your own. In either case, you're never really free. Exploitation never disappears, it only changes how it presents itself according to the complaints of its time. And managers, well, their new role is a little more precarious. Now that temp workers are so popular, part-time so developed, and now that workers are self-monitoring, being a manager is a more unique position. Workers in these managerial roles are more terrified than ever of losing their job, given the sea of employment without benefits slowly swelling all around them. And that makes them weaker, even more exploitable. This kind of brings us up to where we are now. The study I brought up earlier about how minimum wage workers are being mislabeled managers is pretty explicit. Quote, "Overtime avoidance is more pronounced when firms have stronger bargaining power and employees have weaker rights." After all, why wouldn't capitalists also take advantage of their managers? The category of manager is pretty pointless in a lot of businesses anyway. Companies install spyware on their employees' computers to monitor them automatically. People are basically managing themselves because work is little more than a string of projects with deadlines. And their cubicle has a big hole in the side of it. If all you need is someone to discipline the other workers, just pick anyone at random and take advantage of them all the same. Most of the time, the manager is only there to give pissed off customers someone to complain to. It's a useless job that just about every worker recognizes as useless. But useless jobs, in this case having little sock puppets to act as a shield for capital, is exactly what the owner class needed. So here we are. At the end of the day, no matter how many changes capitalist rhetoric goes through, no matter how much the responsibilities of the people directly above you evolve, so long as the relationship between the ruling class and the working class is not allowed to change, we will never be free. If we want real freedom, the opportunity to have financial security and pursue a life that is truly worthwhile, capitalism needs to go. And because I'll inevitably get comments saying, yeah, but how do we do that? The answer is the same as it's always been. Look how entrenched powers were overcome in the past. It's always the majority rising up to force change. So open up a new tab, search CPUSA and the name of your city, or PSL, or FRSO, or DSA, or whatever your country's equivalents are, and join up. You want to see what self-management really looks like? Get involved. It's the only way humans have ever built a better life. I mentioned at the beginning of the video that this episode was made possible by Henson Shaving. This is a new one for me, and I'm actually really glad they reached out, because I've been using safety razors for years. It's just a way better experience than those awful little cartridge razors or a big electric one you have to recharge all the time. Anyway, besides just making my preferred style of razor, Henson Shaving actually has a really cool story. Their background is in aerospace machining. They've built parts for the Mars rover and the ISS. So, as a space nerd and a safety razor snob, I was only too happy to try out this guy, the Henson AL-13. What sets this razor apart from pretty much anything else on the market is how precisely it's made. These things are made to crazy tight tolerances. The blade extends just enough and at a perfect 30 degrees to take all the guesswork out of the shaving angle. Plus, the blade is supported across its entire length, which makes for the smoothest shave I've ever experienced. Seriously, I've been using this thing for a couple months now and I haven't nicked myself once. One thing I've always hated about the shaving industry is how wasteful it is. Over 2 billion disposable razors end up in landfills every year. Henson Shaving had a problem with that too, so they built this thing to last a lifetime. It's all metal, their packaging is plastic-free, and it takes standard double-edged blades that are completely recyclable. The blades are super affordable too. A box of 100 will easily last you a year, and each blade is like 10 cents. And as a little bonus for supporting my channel, Henson will throw in a box of blades completely free when you purchase a razor. So if you'd like to help support my channel, reduce landfill waste, and get the best shave of your life from a product that will last a lifetime, go to hensonshaving.com/secondthought and enter the code SECONDTHOUGHT at checkout. Make sure you've got both the razor and the blades in your cart to get the blades completely free. Give the AL13 a try today. It's a great product, and it really does help support my channel. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other work by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.